Hello, friends. James Corbett here, CorbettReport.com. Here we are in the chilly climes of Groningen in northern Netherlands, as promised. And it's actually not nearly so chilly as I expected. But here I am joined by an old friend of mine who you might recall if you are a keen listener to the Corbett Report. He has been on the program before. I'm referring to Professor Tjeerd Andringa of the University of Groningen. Tjeerd, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
And thank you for making my trip to Groningen possible. I very much appreciate it.
That was definitely a pleasure.
Excellent. Yeah. Well, tell us, first of all, for those of you watching the video of this, this is in an incredibly amazing, miraculous room. Where are we?
We are now in one of the pompous rooms of our university. It is, as far as I know, the room of the curators of the university. So that are the people who can actually fire the board of the university.
Wow. Yeah, so the seat of power of the
seat
university.
Of power, yeah, definitely. Ooh. Yeah. It was the only room that was available.
Wait, am I sitting in the seat of power?
No, you're not. Okay. The seat of power is down there.
Okay, all right.
Yeah.
All right.
Well, we are the observers of the seats of power.
Yes.
Which we always are.
Well, exactly right. We have a good eyes view of the seat of power. Well, let's talk about something philosophical today.
Okay.
For those of you who don't know, I had a subscriber video last month in which I was asking the subscribers' opinions on the question of falsification. How do we, not how do we know what we know, but how can we potentially prove the things that we believe to be wrong so that we do not fall into the trap of being unfalsifiable?
Falsifiability is a simple concept. If a statement or theory can't be proven false, it is not scientific. For example, the sky outside is cloudy could be considered a scientific statement because it can't be proven wrong. It is falsifiable.
And this requires a bit of setup, I suppose, to explain this concept rather than me trying to articulate that. What do you take falsification to be?
Well, falsification is a process to figure out whether your expectations about something are actually correct. And so you come up with an expectation, you call the hypothesis, and then you say that hypothesis should hold in a certain situation. And then you look in that situation, you conduct an experiment or something like that, and then reality will tell whether or not the situation is as it is expected.
Right.
And when it's not as expected, it's not false. It's not supported. It's falsified. And therefore, we say we can reject this particular hypothesis.
So my understanding is the idea is it's important because if we are able to make a prediction from what we already know, and that prediction can be proven either false or true, then it doesn't mean we're correct, but it means we are at least able to verify in some way whether we are incorrect.
Yes and no. The yes part is you can also only prove something in a closed environment. Mm. So you always have to say, let's suppose that this and this and this and this holds, and then given that we think that this and this, or that we prove that it actually holds, and then within that environment, then we can say we can prove something. We can falsify it or say, yeah, we disprove it. But in an open environment, you can't prove anything because you can't say that you can't control all the variables. So you can only falsify in a closed environment.
I mean, that makes a lot of sense. And that therein poses the very problem, the sort of core of the problem of what I'm dealing with, because I'll tell you where this arose from. I was thinking, I mean, I've thought about this for years, but I was thinking specifically about something like the plane crash of Christophe de Margerie recently, the Total CEO. And when we hear about that, I mean, first off, you think, oh, this is an anti-petrodollar CEO. He's been called a friend of Putin. He dies in a mysterious plane crash. Obviously, people of Corbett Report bent might think immediately, well, there's something suspicious there. And, you know, you might even start with the hypothesis that the plane was brought down on purpose. But then you learn, for example, well, the plane didn't just crash, it hit a snowplow and thus exploded or whatever on the runway. And so then you think, well, the snowplow driver must have been in on it or something. And then maybe if that is disproven, then you think, well, then the snowplow was controlled remotely. But then if that is disproven somehow, then you forward the next line of defense. And it goes back in a seemingly endless chain of potential conspiracy. And my concern is that we can get trapped in that to the point where we never put forward a theory that will ever be proven wrong, because there is this shadowy power behind the scenes that can do anything. And if that is a variable in our hypothesis, then we will never be wrong.
Yeah. Well, at least never be proven wrong.
Well,
well, that is definitely a possibility. So we are talking about explanations about the world. And if you limit yourself to a particular set of explanations and you allow that set of explanations to perpetuate itself, even in the face of contradicting evidence the lack of supporting evidence to continue, then you will always remain trapped in that particular set of hypotheses. Mm-hmm. So the proper way to address this is to be open for all kinds of different hypotheses and then simply learned how to weight the evidence that you have and never settle down quite in some explanation, but simply say, well, that the conspiracy explanation is not so likely in this case, but the alternative explanation or whatever, the mainstream or just bad luck, whatever, is a very good one. And then all of a sudden you get some more information, and then the conspiracy one becomes more prevalent. Mm-hmm. Or the other way around.
Right.
So don't think the world is closed. In a closed world, you can prove that one and one is two. Mm-hmm. But in the real world, we always have to work with options that might be more likely than other options.
Yes. Yes, because obviously this is, I don't know if it's a metaphor or if it's an exact use, but it obviously comes from science, where things are done in a laboratory setting, experiments can be conducted,
exactly,
which cannot be done in the case of global geopolitics.
No, and that is something that I find really interesting. So in an open world, something that you can't control for all the variables, so you can't prove that everything that is necessary for you in order to come up with a testable hypothesis is actually there. Mm-hmm. So you can't work this way. So you can't prove anything anymore. But you can do something else. And we do it all the time. I mean, it's called understanding. You can try to understand it. And so one way of thinking about it is to make the separation between the weather and climate. So the weather is something that happens. It's like the news. All kinds of things are happening. You can measure them. You can record them. You can do all kinds of things with them. But climate is something else. Climate is the aggregate of all these kinds of things. And in some climates, you have more cold or more wind, more whatever. And in the weather, by just looking at the weather, you can't say very much about the climate. And by knowing the climate, you can't say very much about the weather at one particular point in time. But you can say something about the patterns of weather. And so if you say, I understand the climate, the current climate, then you can say, okay, therefore I expect a certain pattern of events. And I expect it to rain quite often in Central Asia and to be nice and mild weather in the center of Africa or something like that. But that doesn't mean that you can actually predict the weather at each point in time.
Yes. I very much like this analogy, because I think it is what I'm doing in my work, is looking at the overall picture, the overall trend, the overall storyline narrative that helps to make sense of these events that are happening. But isn't the analogy flawed? Because in the sense of constructing an understanding of climate through weather, you can measure the weather on every single day. It is raining today, it is sunny, there's so many millimeters of precipitation, the dew point is whatever. There are a million ways to quantify that. But the point of this is that if we cannot determine conclusively in that same way whether it's raining or sunny, whether this plane crash was a conspiracy or not, then how do we construct that picture of the climate? Because the climate is based on all of these weather events that we can measure, but we can't measure them.
Well, you have some evidence all the time. Mm-hmm. So as long as you keep the evidence open and you don't impose a certain interpretation on the evidence, you're safe. It is still weather data. Mm-hmm. When you're going to impose certain interpretations on it and say, oh, this must be a typical example of, say, a tropical climate, mm-hmm. and this is also a typical tropical climate, and you're and that is the only evidence that you use, then you just convince yourself that we are in the tropics. Mm-hmm. Well, it was just a hot day in a temperate climate.
Yeah.
So the idea is to sample enough points, and then you can see the whole pattern.
Yeah. And let me strain the analogy to its ultimate breaking point here. So the idea is, for example, I mean, we have an idea generally that we formed for whatever reason, on whatever basis, of the climate. And we are almost being asked to tell the weather from that perspective of the climate.
Yes.
Which is going to be inartful and inexact.
Yep.
And open to change based on new data. So it's almost like we have the climate of the Netherlands, and we're sitting here in a room in November, and assuming if it was a windowless room, what's the weather today? That's not exactly what we're doing. It's almost like we're getting reports from outside the room. This is the weather today, and we're mm-hmm. trying to decide whether or not that is a likely scenario. Maybe this analogy is starting to lose its ability to help us.
No, but I think you can. The weather is predictable, but it's only predictable to limited extent. You can predict the weather a few days ahead, but you can't predict the weather more than, well, say, a week ahead.
What, 100 years ahead?
100 years ahead, it makes no sense. But it probably the climate will more or less be the same. There might be some climate change or not, but the weather is to some extent predictable. So if you see all kinds of clouds forming in Central Asia, well, it will probably rain there, mm. or it might even become a thunderstorm, and then that might be a war analogy or something like
right,
that.
Right,
but
right,
at
right.
the same time, all those clouds and all the moisture that is necessary will not be at some other place, mm. Because we have a finite amount of moisture in the air.
Yes.
So at another place, it must be, it can't rain at the same time.
Yes.
And of course, you don't know exactly how those patterns are going to be, but the total sum is going to say you something.
All right. Well, let's leave this analogy.
Yes.
So that we don't get too engrossed in the analogy. All right. So what does this tell us about how to proceed with any particular given event other than, I mean, for example, with the plane crash? What should we do from this point to try to, I mean, I would say that the basis of how we proceed with any investigation is, yes, of course, we're going to have a hypothesis or gut feeling or whatever as we go into it. But shouldn't we be trying... Should we be specifically trying to prove ourselves wrong? Is that the way to proceed?
No, I wouldn't do that. And that is, prove yourself wrong, you can only do that in a closed environment.
Right.
So we are not in it. So I wouldn't even try to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So, but what you can do, and that is the proper way to do, is simply trying to figure out what is the reliable evidence that we have, and patterns in there, and going to the larger context, and then at a certain moment, you are in a stage in which you know the context to a pretty high degree. And then the only thing that you actually don't know is that little bit that you're now investigating. Mm-hmm. And maybe the context will actually say how to interpret that.
Mm-hmm.
And like also in linguistics, it's well known that if you drop a single word from a sentence, people fill that word in.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that is more or less what we do. But
yeah.
You need the context.
You know what? I think this is a very helpful conversation because it helps to clarify for me. I mean, I think if we continue with the weather climate, rather than going from weather to climate as we do in real life, I think, mm-hmm. in the environment, I think what we are doing in this context is going from a climate to weather.
Actually, we do both.
Mm.
And we the weather informs the climate,
yeah,
the news
yeah, yeah.
informs
right.
our understanding of the whole world,
mm-hmm.
and our understanding of the world
mm-hmm.
informs the interpretation of little events. And with that interpretation of smaller events, we are going to look for particular evidence. And mm-hmm. when we find it, okay, that is supporting evidence for that particular interpretation. And so we are not falsifying. We are searching for supporting evidence, but in a structured way, given on our understanding of the whole.
So I think for the purposes of understanding the world, the understanding of the climate is the more important.
I would say so, yes.
Yeah.
And the weather or the particular geopolitical events, well, actually it doesn't matter so much whether the bombing was in one place or another place. Mm. What is interesting is who were involved, whether they were at place A or place B.
Yes.
Yeah, and who benefits typically.
All right. Well, I think that is helpful in a lot of ways.
Okay.
I don't know how
I
to process this at the moment in terms of what I do, but I'm going to cogitate on it. Which I would expect nothing less from a professor in the cognitive sciences to make me cogitate on things. All right, well, thank you very much. Is there anything else you'd like to add on this subject?
No, I don't think so.
Why don't you tell people how they can find out more about yourself and your work?
I maintain a website. It's called geopoliticsandcognition.com. I haven't done much about it at this moment, at least for the last year, but I will maintain it more or less. Currently, I'm involved in setting up a university college, which is great fun, but it's also, well, quite taxing. But it's a very good way of really thinking about what it means to be a teacher and what it is to teach people how to think properly.
Yeah.
And then we are exactly in these kind of things.
Mm. Yeah. Interesting. Well, I want to thank you once again for this conversation and for making it possible by bringing me here. So thank you very much.
It was a pleasure.
Excellent. Yeah.